With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. A big shout going out to everyone in Rose Hill today in Sutton. Many people, again, are coming out against ULEZ, the ultra low emission zone. Sadiq Khan has been trying to, let's just call it what it is, bribe more people, but giving people £5,000 to scrap something and then they have to pay £30,000 for a new van when they've got a perfectly adequate van already is not that much of a great bribe, is it? Let's be honest. And 50% of vans are not going to be compliant as they stand at the moment. And that's aside from all the people who've got all the vehicles, and it's just not necessary. We've seen all sorts of devious things, lies, talking about deaths, making things up. But people, the public, are challenging things. And in fact, they're using their democratic freedoms to organize, to campaign, to protest, to lobby, and to challenge. And in spite of smears and name calling, because clearly people don't seem to want to be able to communicate the actual arguments, the virtue of their positions. But it's very exciting, encouraging that people are doing that, as well as challenging low traffic neighborhoods, 15-minute cities up and down the country. At Together, we've got local regional ambassadors and hubs. There's more news happening, not just in Bristol that we featured last week, but also Edinburgh and Glasgow that will be coming to you. There'll be more events that are going on and more campaigns to challenge these impositions. And that's an essential part of the democratic free society, the ability for citizens to challenge, to question, to put forward alternatives, to put pressure on elected representatives. And we haven't seen as much of that. In the last few decades, there's been a little bit of a retreat of the public from that. And I'd say in many ways, a kind of technocratic managerialism that's ensued. A lot of the big ideas that were in the 20th century, many of them associated with some of the problems, the terrible things that happened. And I think that many sort of retreated from the very idea that humans could shape and change the world. But we have seen enormous challenges with everything from the United States with the Tea Party and Occupy movements. And then, of course, some of the populism and with Donald Trump and other things. And in the United Kingdom, different again, but certainly with Brexit, a big challenge. Those who were for Remain, it was a big national debate, a big struggle, much in the public and the mainstream media told many people they were stupid and they didn't know what they were doing. We're very lucky today because we're going to be talking to two of the authors of a book that's just come out called Taking Control, Sovereignty and Democracy After Brexit. And I know that a lot of people now, some people who are kind of committed Remainers are saying, well, look at this, Brexit's just a disaster. The very idea of Brexit is a disaster, not how it's been implemented or not being implemented or what it means. And so today we're going to be joined by Peter Ramsey and Phil Cunliffe, Philip Cunliffe, two of the authors alongside Lee Jones and George Hoare, to talk about this. So I'm very pleased that, first of all, Pete Ramsey is with us. And Pete is at the London School of Economics. He's widely published as an academic and always has very interesting things to say. And I'm very excited that he's here with us today. Pete, welcome to the show.
Hi, Alan. Good to be here.
Good. So just if you would, in a nutshell, tell us what's inspired this book, Taking Control, Sovereignty and Democracy After Brexit, and just talk us through the key points of it, if you would, please.
Okay, so the book is about national sovereignty and democracy. It is fundamentally about how, if we as citizens want to gain control of the state, if we want to take back democracy, as I think you've put it yourself, Alan, then we need something much better than our current political parties. And the core of our argument is that if we're going to get something better politically, then we need to understand what national sovereignty means. We need to understand it much better than we have done up to now, because national sovereignty provides the basis for a new set of politics if we think it through, or at least that's what we argue in the book. So the book is trying to offer a new perspective from which we could develop a new democratic politics based on the challenge of national sovereignty in the 21st century, rather than harking back to the problems and issues of the 20th century. So that's the elevator pitch, I suppose.
So can I ask you? Yeah. So just on that, right? Because we use these words and sometimes people nod, or sometimes people say they're just weaponized or whatever. But just, sorry to be very pedestrian, but what do you mean when you say national sovereignty?
Well, can I come back to that? I'll just say a little bit more about how we go about the book, and I can get to that, which is the way we investigate national sovereignty in the book is through a political analysis of Brexit. So like you said, now a lot of people are fed up with it, have had enough of it, wish it had never happened, or so we're told, at least, by pollsters. It seems to me that whether you're a Leaver or a Remainer, whether you've had enough of it or not, we have to understand it better, because it is just the most important political shakeup in Britain, certainly since the 1980s. And really, and as we argue in the book, it's the biggest constitutional crisis and change in Britain since before the First World War. And the reason why it's such a big event, whether you like it or not, or you're fed up with it or not, is that Brexit has confronted us with the challenge of national sovereignty. And most of our political class don't want to face that challenge. Even after Brexit, they prefer to stick in the supranational forums and organisations where they can cook up policy along with their mates in the elites of other states. And they don't want to, they're just uncomfortable. They don't want to have to derive their policies by asking us, ordinary British citizens, what our needs might be and what we want. And even, we argue in the book that even that smaller part of the British political class that talked about national sovereignty, the Eurosceptics who led the campaign for Brexit and to leave the EU, they never really understood what national sovereignty meant. And as a result, they dropped the ball badly after Brexit. And that's why people are reacting against it. So the book's not a history of Brexit. We're only writing about, we write about what it meant to be a member state of the EU, how that involves the decay of national sovereignty, how the process of leaving the EU doesn't of itself restore national sovereignty, but it has utterly exhausted all of the longstanding tendencies in British politics. So that's how the book goes about it. But we only do that in order to try to explain the political condition of the British nation now after Brexit, and to try to get a better grip on the challenge of national sovereignty and how we can use that to rejuvenate democracy. Okay, so that's what the book, how the book goes about it. Now the question, what is sovereignty? That's, we're going to have to get a little deep for lunchtime on a sunny Saturday, it's a hard question, but I'll explain it this way. There are two aspects to sovereignty. The first is not well known. The first is very well known and was understood by all sides in the Brexit debate. But the second is much more important, and it's much less well understood. That's the way we approach the question in the book. The well known part of sovereignty is that in any state, someone, a person, a king, a sovereign, or an assembly, a parliament, has the ultimate lawmaking power in the territory. That's when there's no higher law than what Parliament says in Britain. In Britain, it's Parliament. The sovereignty. Technically, for lawyers, it's the Crown in Parliament, but for our purposes, it's Parliament that has that ultimate legal power. And we could call this legal sovereignty. And the Remainers and Europhiles thought this was old-fashioned and kind of autarkic, and we should share this power with other states, our neighbouring states, and pool it with them. And that was a much more kind of modern thing to do. Eurosceptics insisted that citizens of the nation represented in Parliament should have the final say, and that we had to bring it back. Now, it's important, but Eurosceptics often downplayed an important part of this. When we were a member state of the EU, it's true that EU law was supreme over any act of Parliament. So if there was a conflict between an act of Parliament and an EU law, the EU law would triumph. And in that sense, our sovereignty was diminished. But it's important to remember that Parliament voluntarily outsourced its legal sovereignty. We were never a colony of the European Union. As soon as Parliament repealed the European Communities Act 1972, which it did after Brexit, Parliament's sovereignty was restored. We were never forced into this. It was always a voluntary thing. Anyway, that's legal sovereignty. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, really, of the whole of sovereignty. And it's the bit lying underneath, a much larger bit lying underneath the surface, which is the thing that makes legal sovereignty possible and worth having, and wasn't discussed by any side, really, and overlooked entirely through the Brexit process. Political sovereignty is the authority that public institutions in the state have. It's an authority that the sovereign possesses over the territory and the people who live within it. And when we say authority, I don't mean power. It's not the power and authority are not quite the same thing, although they overlap. If I've got political power over other people, it means I can overcome their resistance. I want them to do something, they don't want to do it, I can overcome them, I have power over them. I can police them, I can regulate them. And the state has power, but if I have political authority, that's because people will voluntarily do what I want them to do. They won't do what I don't want them to do. And the more authority that I have, the less I have to police people or regulate them or force them or coerce them. So a state and its parliament, our state, our parliament, can have both power and authority, but the authority is much more important. And the problem is that authority rests on some degree of trust between those who have the authority and those who recognize it and work underneath it. And that's what's broken down in the years of EU membership. I don't think that I'm saying anything controversial there. Most people do not trust our representatives. They don't trust the parties. They don't trust the bureaucracies of the government. In return, we're now fully aware that the parties and the bureaucracies don't trust us either. In the book, that's what we call the void at the heart of the state. There's a political void where there needs to be a relationship of authority and trust. And states like ours, which don't have it, where that void has come and replaced authority and trust, where the void arose because political parties have retreated into the state, they've retreated into the bureaucracies, they've retreated into the councils of the European Union, into international organizations, into those kind of areas. We, the citizens, retreated into private life. We stopped taking much interest in politics. And as a result of that, we have this void there. And when that relationship is weak, all the authorities can do is police and regulate us. But they find they can't serve our interests. And as a result, we have a state that's not very effective, as we can all see now. It produces policies that don't do things that we need. And they're not very good at doing things that we need because we're not there. We're not there in the policymaking process. Citizens are not present. That's the political sense of sovereignty, the political authority of the state, the trust between us citizens and the state representatives, so that when they pass the laws that they've got back this legal sovereignty, when they pass the laws, we think of them as our laws. Even if we don't agree with the law, we think, okay, but they're our representatives, they were fairly elected, we don't like this one, but we can come back and maybe replace them and get a law we like better. We feel the system is our system, that it serves us, that it's accountable to us, that it represents us. And it's that breakdown of representation that's the real undermining of sovereignty that happened during the years when we were in the EU. And merely leaving the EU doesn't solve that. It brings back the legal sovereignty.
Yeah. But it doesn't. You've explained that really, really well, Pete. I want to come back to this question on the void and authority and trust. We're going to have a quick break. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Professor Pete Ramsey. This is TNT Radio. Come back just after the break.
TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Mike Pence, I still don't understand how he gets 5% in the polls. Forget January 6th. Forget election. Just stick with Mike Pence and what he did with COVID and public health. He wrote his recent book, where he literally announced, it declared in the book, that he helped get masks across America to make sure Americans were masked for our safety, with no hint of, oh, that may have been a mistake. He literally bragged about working, and that was working with 3M to get masks everywhere, to get those kids masked up, those kindergartners and toddlers. Let's mask them up for a few years. That ought to be good for their development, intellectual and speech habits. Then Mike Pence, in his book, his new autobiography, also wrote about how he bragged about how he got ventilators in hospitals, and every report coming out is how ventilators kill. It was one of the most ill-advised things. And that's fine if he thought he was doing something good at the time, but there's something called truth and accuracy. He should at least either ignore it now or admit it was a mistake. Not Mike Pence. Mike Pence also praised Fauci in the book. Mike Pence was at every vaccine and every lockdown press conference, nary a word of complaint ever.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. I'm here with Professor Pete Ramsey talking about his new book that he's co-authored with several other authors called Taking Control, Sovereignty and Democracy After Brexit. And Pete, you just made a really important, insightful argument that I think even if people have just recently come to looking at politics or what's been going on in the last 3 years, will resonate with many people, sort of weak authoritarians that are in power, that don't have authority. And you talk about the corrosion, the collapse of authority and trust. And I think many people would identify with that. But one thing I would ask is that it's not just, you could say that about Britain and in relationship to the EU, people might say, okay, yeah, I get that. But trust seems to have dissolved internationally, where the trust in many places, even Australia, even in America, where there's more of a sense of the idea of the American mission, the American dream, the project, there's a kind of erosion of a sense of trust of politicians and others. There's a cynicism. Obviously, there's the culture wars within all of this as well. Are you saying that's all because of people being involved in, nation states being involved in supranational organizations? I mean, how does that marry up? I understand your argument about this in relationship to what happened with the EU and our own leaders jettisoning responsibility and sort of, you know, allowing the laws from the EU say, look, you know, we don't have to take responsibility. This is where the issue is. But how does that relate more broadly? Because we see this collapse of trust everywhere, don't we?
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. It's not unique to Britain. The European Union is just, all of the European Union member states suffer from this, the same problem, the void, the political void at the heart of their states. And it's probably, I don't want to comment, I'm not confident to say in detail about the United States, but from what we see of American politics, it seems to suffer from the same problem. Electoral turnouts fall. People become cynical with the main parties. They certainly don't. More and more people don't trust them. And so that's happening right across the world. Historically, I mean, you have to look back in history to say, how did it happen? And I think it happened because we look in the book at the story of the decline of, we call it the voiding of Britain's national sovereignty, which occurred over the course of the 1980s and the 1990s, because when Britain was a more confident national sovereignty and where those, they were stronger, I mean, they could have, they weren't perfect by any means, but there were stronger relations of trust. That was because people were engaged in a politics which was conflictual. There were, you know, trade unionists and socialists and the Labour Party on one side and conservatives on the other side. But that very conflict meant that people were engaged in politics and they had much more trust in the people who really represented them. And so out of that, you could create the sense of that we all belonged to the same nation, and that was a project that we were engaged in. And so the nation state had this kind of room for maneuver and authority with its population, so it could come up with effective policies. Now, whatever we think about the two sides of 20th century politics, that ended in the late 1980s. That way of building the nation out of its own internal conflicts was ended by the victory of one side over the other. And afterwards, politics, and I think this happened everywhere, became the two sides. It was obvious that the politics of the left were defeated and the parties of the left gave up. It was less obvious, but it's now clearer, that the politics of the right was defeated, conservatism was defeated. And so both sides have tended to this middle of, well, we accept the market system, but we need to regulate you. And that, what we call loosely neoliberal consensus, is what emerged. And it's in the same process. Then what happens is that everyone in the political parties, higher up the political parties, everybody in the state bureaucracies, everyone in the, all of the penumbra of institutions that surround policymaking, like NGOs, charities, universities, places like where I work, they all start talking to each other. They no longer they don't need to talk to the citizenry, because there's no political conflict within society which requires them to talk to anybody lower down, and they end up talking to each other. And we get famously the revolving door between politics and big corporate interests as well. And so what we've seen is that policy development and politics and new laws are dominated by the interests of this class, what are generally called the professional middle classes now. And the professional middle classes get to completely dominate policy, because the system's not under any pressure really from below, either from its old wage earning trade union constituency or from its old more provincial conservative constituencies, which are big constituencies that constitute most of the population but don't have to be listened to anymore. So that, yes, that problem is more or less universal.
So it was remarkable in Britain that for a while it seemed like people were talking about politics everywhere during Brexit, and obviously people fell out, if families, friends, some new alliances occurred, but it was kind of everywhere. If you know, people from nurses to, you know, people delivering the mail and dustbins to corporate people, a range of people all talking about it and arguing, and it was on the news all the time, and there were both sides of the arguments were being put forward and articulated. That it does seem as though there's this exhaustion now subsequently, and is it just because there's a lack of trust, there's a void, or what's happened, do you think, this whole let's get Brexit done, for instance, right? Yep. It was a bit of a kind of catchy phrase and everything, but what's happened, what would it have meant to have really implemented something that would mean exercising full sovereignty, and why hasn't it happened? Was it that COVID came along? I mean, lots of excuses are put forward. What's your thought on it?
Well, you're right to raise Get Brexit Done, the slogan on which Boris Johnson won the 2019 general election and got Brexit done, in the sense that as a result of winning that general election, Britain did in fact leave the European Union after 3 years of political chaos over that question. But Get Brexit Done in itself, as we say in the book, and we some of us argued at the time, that Get Brexit Done, the slogan, already carries a kind of tiredness with Get Brexit Done, we've had enough of that Brexit. And that was back in 2019, before it happened. And so at the same time as it was like saying, well, we're serious about Brexit, as the Conservative Party was at that moment, it also suggested that it wasn't very excited about it. It didn't see much opportunity in it. It was a thing of the past, get it over with and move on. And so almost immediately, you know, we left the European Union in January 2020, and then immediately COVID comes along. And so you could say, well, then they became, everyone, politics became obsessed by COVID, and that was an international phenomenon. But it seems the way we look at it, the book, is it shows that the organized conservative forces, the Eurosceptics, who saw through who got Brexit done, to put it that way, didn't really have any dynamic, believable policies that most of us wanted to buy into. And so the COVID lockdown was kind of convenient in a way, in that it covered that up with something else. And also, and this is the point we make about lockdown, which is very important. We'd left the European Union, but lockdown policy shows all the pathologies of member states, of a political void. So, you know, what happened was that they faced with a respiratory virus that everybody knew was affected old people and people with existing comorbidities much more severely than young or healthy people. Faced with this, they followed the policy of the Chinese Communist Party, you know, which had never been tried before, of suspending civil liberties, of scaring the living daylights out of us, rather than doing what was proposed by the signatories of the Great Barrington Declaration themselves, you know, experts in the field. They didn't. What they proposed was that we mobilize the population to actually protect the vulnerable, and then get on with life normally for everybody else. Now, that, it seems to me, would be what the Great Barrington Declaration was proposing is exactly what you would do if you took your national sovereignty seriously. You would mobilize the population to solve the immediate health emergency that you had. But our decayed political states that are governed by rulers that have no real relationship with the population couldn't work out how to do that. In Britain, they had hundreds of thousands of people who signed up to volunteer, but they couldn't work out how to. It was beyond their imagination how you would mobilize the population of the nation to solve a problem. Whereas it came naturally to them to regulate us, to police us, to repress us, because that's what these decayed states do. So in that sense, Brexit got done, but it got done by a political party which really didn't have any ideas. It wasn't that. It was interested in free trade. They didn't like the EU because the EU, they thought, was a trade bloc that prevented them doing trade deals elsewhere. Most Leave voters weren't particularly interested in that. Only about 6% of voters were interested in those policies. And so when the trouble started immediately after Brexit, the whole system just defaulted to what member states do, to what states without a real relationship of authority with their populations do. Instead of doing, if we'd been confident in our national sovereignty, government would have mobilized us to protect the vulnerable and the rest of us to get on with our lives. And we'd be in a lot better position now if we'd done that.
So in a minute, after the next break, I'm going to ask our next guest, Dr. Philip Cunliffe, who's a senior lecturer in international conflict at University of Kent and also a co-author, to join us on here. And perhaps we can have both of you for a little while and then I'll carry on with him. But this question now is really imperative that you've honed in on as well, because you said earlier that the problem of the void of authority and trust goes both ways. It's not just that the public don't, in large part, trust elected representatives. It's also that they don't trust the public. And I think that's particularly evident. I certainly saw it in my own professional career in hospitality and licensing when I started getting involved in challenging some of the things and lobbying, because the whole policy discussions about the public were that we were vectors of crime, antisocial behavior, harms, alcohol related harms and damages. Nothing to do with lighting up the cities, transforming business, creating new cultural phenomenons. None of that, not fashion, not music, not regeneration. It was all harms, dystopian, and needs to be restricted and limited. And this kind of sense of disdain and contempt for the public, this lack of trust, but even more than lack of trust, Pete, I think, isn't it a sort of a horrid, it's almost like the great unwashed revisited, this sense that there's this amorphous, terrible, like white van man, gammon, COVID, all these terms we hear, like nasty, is that the old racial terms actually promoted about ordinary people, quite often white working class people, but just generally the public. that there's this sense that not only it's not just we can't mobilize them, that if you were to get them to do anything, they're all going to end up being like Nazis or out of control. And we've seen that, haven't we, in some of the discussions like Sadiq Khan, when people are challenging ULEZ, or in some of the campaigns. I know in Oxford, for instance, the Oxford Mail said that the far right and the Nazis were coming to march when people were challenging some of the questions around traffic limits and controls. There's this sense that actually people are a really rotten lot generally, isn't there?
Yeah, sure. And we should understand, I think we tend to see this as a kind of, we should be angry about that. These are our rulers and this is what they think of us. But we should understand that it has political purpose, or it serves, it works for them, in the sense that if Brexit voters are all racists, or if people who oppose austerity measures that restrict their freedom of movement in cities like Oxford, or if people doubt that this respiratory virus really justifies a massive clampdown on civil liberties and everything that went with that, then they are conspiracy theorists and crazy and irrational. What that does in the mind of our political elite and the people who support them is it means that not only are they not accountable to us, so, you know, they don't have to be accountable to us because we're all racist and crazy conspiracy theorists, but it would be wrong for them to be accountable to us. If you look at it from their point of view, it relieves their consciences of the burden of democracy. They don't have to think about us because we're all beyond the pale. And that's the way that argument, I think, that's why that argument has come everywhere. It's particularly why I think there's a big push on certain issues where certain minorities are promoted in order constantly to target, prejudicially, to target all of us as backward. It's a means of repudiating, by which the political elite can repudiate their accountability to us. And even in their own minds, in their own consciences, it explains to them why they don't have to care about us, because we're all beyond the pale. And we should understand the whole targeting of whiteness and all of these things as serving a very clear political function of justifying to the professional middle classes and to the mainstream political world their unwillingness to listen to us or be accountable to us.
So that's, I mean, it's fascinating. But the thing is also, there's a backlash to all of that, isn't there? I mean, we've seen that happen in the United States when that's been weaponized. And that really is what the culture, people talk about in the culture wars. They talk about this woke thing. But this sense that people just disregard or call a whole section of society somehow that they're just like, just beyond the pale in your terms, or Hillary Clinton's called them other things. But there's a backlash to that, because obviously then there is a sense that people want to fight back, they want to challenge, or they want to at least have their voices heard. A lot of people are politically homeless here in the UK. They're looking around, some of them. It's not like, you know, so I want to ask you about this taking control, what towards a democratic Britain means. We're going to go to a break in a couple of minutes, but do you want to just start on that? And then when we come in after the break, we'll bring in Phil as well, and we can talk a bit together about that. What? How do you see that taking control? What does a democratic Britain really mean from the point of view of the book and you guys?
Well, the first thing is that I really welcome the fact that people are pushing back, and that citizens, all of us are not, that lots of us are not willing to lie down and take the defamation, take the insults. You know, and that was very apparent in Brexit. One of my colleagues at the London School of Economics, who became a firm supporter of leaving the European Union, he said about a week after the referendum, he said, you know, I voted to remain, but I really regret it now because of the virulent hostility and defamation of Leave voters that, you know, we were surrounded by in a London university. So I think that people are waking up to the fact that our rulers live in this bubble of their own, and then they don't know anything. What was astonishing to me was that they simply didn't, my colleagues, lots of them didn't know anything about Britain, and they weren't really interested either. So I think people are pushing back against that. And I think on the travel stuff at the moment, the anti-LTN stuff, that's very apparent that we have these small networks of the middle classes who dominate the local political system and simply have no idea how ordinary most people live in a city like Oxford, how they depend on their cars. They can't just stop using them. So that I think it's very important. And there's lots of initiatives and lots going on. What I think what we're trying to say in the book is if these local pushbacks are to really turn into something that can solve the problem, we have to start thinking about the nation building. What the problem we have is if the political system no longer represents us, we think we live in a nation, you know, it's got a flag and we got a, you know, we've got a monarchy and we have all these this history, but in fact it lacks real political life because its sovereign institution, parliament, no longer represents us, and the majority of voters, as was revealed in a recent opinion poll, don't feel represented by any of the main parties who are in parliament. And that's a real, we have to think hard about how we build a nation. So liberals have gone on for many years about building nations and nation building in Afghanistan or Somalia or somewhere. But actually the real problem is at home. How do we build a new sense of ourselves as a nation? And we don't think that there's any going back. We called the book Taking Control. We were obviously riffing on the famous slogan of the Vote Leave campaign, take back control. We don't think there's any going back to national sovereignty. The project of national
sovereignty. Can I hold you there, Pete? That's very important. Yeah. There's a good point to pause. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Pete Ramsey's TNT Radio. Come back to us just after this break.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
We're more than a year away from the Democrat and Republican Party nominating conventions, but already people are starting to express concerns over what role AI might play in the election. Darrell West, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Technology Innovation, says it's going to be very difficult for voters to distinguish the real from the fake, and you could just imagine how either Trump supporters or Biden supporters could use this technology to make the opponent look bad. There could be things that drop right before the election that nobody has a chance to take down. Gee, you think? Let's just take a little lesson from our military, who decided to see what would happen if you tasked AI with conducting drone strikes against surface-to-air missile batteries. There was a human override failsafe that would instruct the drones not to engage a target, but the AI decided that because it identified a SAM battery, it should destroy the SAM battery, and therefore the human was the problem. Thankfully, the drones weren't armed because the drones tried to take out the human that was sending it an override signal. Recognizing their quote-unquote programming error, they told the drones not to attack the human. So what did the drones do instead? They attacked the radio towers that were connecting the human to the drone. Sure, this technology can't get out of hand and cause any problems. No, not at all. AI needs to be regulated and regulated fast. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Hi, my name is Marnie Dobek. I'm a family physician, and my son Zachary almost died of sepsis last year. We were lucky. Most people don't know the word sepsis, and they don't know the symptoms. Protect yourself and your loved ones. Know sepsis. To learn more about the symptoms, please go to sepsis.org.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. We were just in the middle of it. Very, very interesting. So we've got Professor Pete Ramsey, who's from Professor of Law at the London School of Economics Law School, and is a co-author of the new book, Taking Control, Sovereignty and Democracy After Brexit. And we're just joined as well by Dr. Philip Cunliffe. As I said earlier, Phil is at the University of Kent and an expert on international relations. And it's an interesting combination, the questions of law, international relations, and obviously the political question. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. But I should add, I've recently moved, so I'm actually at the University College London now. So
fantastic. Right. Well, thanks. Good to let us know that. So just where we've just been talking, I'm not sure how much you heard, Phil, but just about this void and a lack of authority and trust and how that manifests itself. I was beginning to ask Pete just about what taking control really means. But I'm also conscious that a lot of people that will be listening to this, they were concerned. I think some of them would have been, some of them would have not. Some would have been Remain, some of them would have been Brexit around that discussion. But in the more recent conversations, they'll think about organizations like the World Health Organization or maybe the International Monetary Fund that keeps seeming to wanting to weigh in on things. Certainly there's discussions at the moment. Rishi Sunak is saying that Ukraine is absolutely should be part of NATO. And there are all sorts of questions about international organizations. How much is this linked to this idea of, and the World Economic Forum, some people think it's less of a thing than others, United Nations and the WHO, how much is this all part of a similar issue? Or is it possible to be part of an international organization which represents member states, with strong member states that have their own sovereignty? Or do they, by default, if they get involved in these organizations, jettison? Is it just inevitable that there will be a jettisoning of our sovereignty and that there'll be some technocrats somewhere who are not accountable running things? I mean, how do you see this, Phil?
So I don't think it's inevitable. I think it's certainly been a very conscious strategy, I'd say, for the last 30, 40 years or so, whereby governments, states have very deliberately and consciously bound their hands by joining various kinds of organizations or empowering various kinds of supranational organizations, including various kinds of, some of the agencies associated with the United Nations that you mentioned, as well as NATO, I think would be part of that too. And then they turn around to their, to their voters and their electors and say, look, we can't address your concerns. We can't deal with these problems because we've signed up to all of these agreements. And this is the way the world works now. And we have much less scope to do the things that you might want us to do. So it's not inevitable, but I think it's certainly become part of the standard operating procedure for states over the last 30 years. And I think this is the problem that we try to address in our book, Taking Control. But it's how to break out of that. And really, I think it's also, it's a problem by which, we don't have control over our governments. And it's what we need to do is to try and find a way to make them accountable and responsible once again to us. And that's the challenge that we set out to analyze and to offer, a path out of this mess in the book.
Well, I ask you, Phil, and then I'm going to ask you a separate question, Pete, just on this, because Phil, what people might say, playing devil's advocate, is, well, why not, right? If people really feel that strongly about things, why do they not just more get involved to vote? We've just seen the local elections, very poor turnout. The national elections has been diminishing. Political parties have been diminishing, not then represented by alternative big political parties that are going on. It's like this retreat from the public arena. Why is that happening if people are dissatisfied? That's a question to you. And then after that, I'd like Pete just to come back on, because we did see in Oxford quite a bit of momentum about a candidate that stood independently. But still, generally, independents didn't fare that well this last round of local elections. So just the two different sides of this question about if people are dissatisfied with a lack of representation, if so many people did get engaged or enthused somewhat around Brexit, why is there this sort of lackluster thing, even though some people are actively engaged in things like the anti-LTN, ULEZ things? Why is this the case, that there's this lack of kind of more engagement in your view, Phil?
Yeah, I think the dissatisfaction that you talk about, it's very palpable, and I think it's evident as well in all the insurrections that we've seen at the ballot box in recent years, whether that's Brexit or the support for various populist parties in Europe, or indeed the election of Donald Trump in 2016. So we see these kind of recurrent ballot box revolt and these populist insurrections, but they never go very far. And I think this is something we talk about in the book, particularly with respect to Brexit, that the populists there failed because they thought that all you had to do was withdraw from the European Union and then you know, everything would kind of, in their view, I think they thought everything would kind of spontaneously recalibrate, when in fact, you know, the hard work really should have begun as part of lead, you know, when we left the European Union, that was only the start, should have only been the start. But unfortunately, you know, they thought that was all you had to do. And so really what's needed is to build greater representation, to build, to renew, you know, for people to involve people in the life of the nation, I think. And that's no easy task. And it's more than just kind of seceding from an organization like the European Union. It requires building new representative structures. It requires engaging people. And it requires overcoming that void that you've already mentioned between rulers and ruled. And that's not, you know, that seems to me to be something which is beyond the beyond what populists are capable of, because they imagine it's simply about getting, you know, kind of ejecting a kind of a haughty elite, and then our problems are solved. But in fact, we need enduring structures of representation. We need to mediate conflicts and disputes within society. Our societies require all sorts of contradictions to be resolved. And, you know, that requires longstanding institutions of effective representation.
Very interesting. Yeah. Pete, well, just on this, the thing that we saw locally in the question.
Yeah, well, as you know, Alan, I live in Oxford, and I've been involved with some of the efforts to push back against the council here's measures to restrict people's movement. And there was a by-election in a very safe, solid Labour seat for the local authority elections. And our candidate, a local guy called Michael Evans, he ran the Labour Party incredibly close. To within a few percent in this very safe Labour seat. They had to pull out all the stops in terms of getting their people on the street, mobilising their vote. And we had a very small campaign, to be honest. There weren't that many of us at that time. And what I think, one of the things to think about for people who are listening who are really interested in this, is that one of the bad things also have, every cloud has a silver lining. One of the things about the void is that, it means that, say, in local elections, although in elections generally, turnout is falling. And in local elections, it's very low. And that means that the mainstream existing status quo parties are very vulnerable to any kind of energetic intervention. And so that was what we showed in the Littlemore Rose Hill by-elections. We didn't quite win, but it showed just how close you were. We were up against a much more powerful machine. So at one level, I think one of the most interesting things I think that's happening is, as well as we're seeing in these local campaigns, is that we're seeing former Labour Party members and former Conservative Party members with some political skills now and some political experience being drawn into these campaigns because they've had enough. They've had enough of a Labour Party that is only interested in austerity measures against its own constituencies. And the Conservative elements have had enough against Conservative parties and Liberal Democrat parties that bring in measures that only impact badly on local businesses. And so there's all kinds of things bubbling away there, and the very weakness of the system creates opportunity. Just to add one thing, though, it seems to me that if we're to turn that, like you're raising the wider problem, that there isn't like some gigantic pushback and lots of independent candidates don't succeed, I think ultimately we will struggle to do what Phil was talking about, to get beyond merely complaining about these wicked elites who are always doing us down. We'll struggle to get beyond that until we have something that's more inspiring at a deeper level. We need some overarching idea of what we could do at national level, at what all these local, what would unite or coordinate lots of local campaigns that people are working on and involved in. And that's where we're suggesting that the project of the nation, that rebuilding or building a nation, a political nation, is how we could identify a national interest, interests that are more widely shared and are not derived from all these international organizations, but that are derived from within, from our needs. And I think there's lots of.
Yeah, so that is a facet. It's a really important question, and I want to drill down on that a bit more with both of you, because for some people, the nation state has always meant a certain thing for many people of a certain generation. Some people now associate it with, like they do with decolonizing the curriculum, or with sort of the only thing that Britain's ever done is raped and pillaged. None of the really important things, even the abolition of slavery, which the Royal Navy implemented, they see as a kind of, well, that's, yeah, well, but really they're responsible for having done it in the first place, and you can't put any truck to it. It's like nothing good has come from the nation, basically. And that, yet there were issues with some of the ways that the nation worked and the relationship. But your point about kind of agreed, almost like a moral web, a political web that people could come into. I want to go into that bit more with both of you, and if you both will stay on. But just a question to both of you before we hit the hour. Firstly, Pete, and then Phil. Phil mentioned what's going on in Italy. We've seen that in some other European nations. We've certainly seen what's happened with the farmers in the Netherlands. But this question of proportional representation, that you talked about a big idea, Pete, and about rebuilding the nation. Some are arguing that, well, proportional representation is a much more fair way, and it would get people inspired around it. Can I just get both of your thoughts on it? On is that democratic? Is that about sovereignty against first past the post, or is it not, and why? I know that's a toughie for a minute and a bit for each of you, but if you could go first, Pete, let us know what you think.
Two things. In the book, we support proportional representation, not in the abstract. It's not necessarily always better than first past the post, but because of our concrete particular problem now, which is that the existing parties don't represent us, and first past the post keeps them in place. There's no sign that they're capable of seriously changing their orientation and what they do. And so we need to break up the cartel, the political cartel that runs Westminster, and PR is a way to do that. It won't solve all the problems, because lots of European member state, EU member states have PR, and it doesn't necessarily solve all the problems, because there are problems associated with PR. That's point one. Point two, we propose that PR on its own isn't enough. We also need to end corporate funding of political parties. We need to make the political parties dependent on us. And that's a much harder call. I mean, I think PR would still be a step forward, but we put that because otherwise, PR often liberates party leaderships to be able to do backroom deals after the election. So you never know quite what you're voting for. So I think it needs to be connected with another reform, which we propose, which is that party leaderships are much more dependent on their memberships and supporters.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, one of the criticisms that's frequently made of PR is you end up with coalitions. But at the moment, the decay of the British political system is so great that, you know, the polls suggest we're probably heading for a hung parliament at the next general election anyway. So given how unrepresentative our existing parties are, and that's what the polls suggest, 6 in 10 British voters no longer feel represented in the existing party system. It seems to me that PR is a way to reboot party politics. But it's important, you know, it's, as Pete mentioned, it's integrated as part of a larger package of proposals in the book.
I just wonder if it's fetishizing something, which is a way of doing it differently. And that doesn't build on the aspiration of Brexit, which was to win a significant section, a majority in society. And I get the point about how constituencies are put together and the numbers and the votes. But we're going to have to address this in the start of the second hour. If you'll join us, because I want to carry on a bit more about this nation building discussion and much more on this interesting subject. I'm here with Pete Ramsey and Phil Cunliffe talking about their book, Taking Control, Sovereignty and Democracy After Brexit. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Come back to us after the news, and we'll have our next guest also at the Better Way Conference, which TNT is sponsoring. Thank you.